From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made at an elementary school in Florence, Oregon, where a six-month-old boy named Wilson has the attention of two dozen students. Now, when he speaks, the kids cheer. And when he sits upright, the students ooh and ah. When he flops onto his belly, the kids clap. Wilson is part of a program called Roots of Empathy. Once a month, babies like him are brought to visit classrooms so students can see positive parent-child relationships. They ask parents questions like, has he been sleeping a lot, or does he sometimes get worried? At one point, Wilson's father takes his toy away and Wilson starts to cry. The teacher asks the students, if your friend feels sad, what could you do to make them feel better? The students chime in with their answers. You could ask them to play with you, one girl says. In the short term, the goals of Roots of Empathy as a program is to enhance students' empathetic and social intelligence. In the long term, program organizers hope Roots of Empathy will create the ingredients for a more compassionate society. They believe that delivering these lessons early in life can have lifelong impacts. They say that empathy can be taught. Schools in our area are also incorporating lessons of emotional intelligence and mindfulness into their curricula. They say they can help improve students' behavior and the way they respond when they feel hurt, and they can lead to broader implications on civic discourse in today's world. Now, this hour, let's talk empathy. How do you teach it? When can it be learned? Can we learn it all throughout our life? And is a lack of empathy hurting our political discourse? I'm going to drink some water before the train runs off the tracks. And let me say hello to our guest this hour. Wow. Sybil Prince is from the Harley School. While I drink more water, why don't you tell us what you do at Harley, Sybil? Go ahead.
So I am the hospice service learning and mindfulness educator at our Center for Mindfulness and Empathy Education that develops skills of mindfulness and empathy in our children and youth primarily through experiential programming that's supported by curriculum.
Very good. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Shira May, Executive Director of Partners in Restorative Initiatives. It's been a little while since I've seen you, so tell us what the partnership and the program is here.
Sure. Good to see you again. I just started as executive director this year, and Partners in Restorative Initiatives works with schools, community organizations, and the justice system to strengthen relationships, increase a sense of community, and help people repair harm when it does occur. So we're working with Rochester City School Districts and other districts to create improved school climate and culture.
All right, very good. And Elizabeth Devaney is Director of the Social and Emotional Learning Center at the Children's Institute. Tell us about the work you do.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
We're working primarily with schools, early education centers, and out-of-school time programs on implementing social and emotional learning and really thinking about it as a way to kind of transform educational settings. So we're doing a lot of training, coaching, resources, working with the adults who work with kids and supporting them as they work to develop social and emotional competencies in the children they work with.
Do we have a lack of empathy these days? As a society, are we lacking in empathy?
So I think it's an interesting question. I was thinking about it, reflecting as we were getting ready for this, and I've been hearing people say things like, you know, we're as divisive, you know, since the Civil War in this day and age, and that there's a lot going on in our country right now that's, you know, having an impact on how kids are thinking about each other. And there's sort of a push, I think, to, you know, take a side and not have empathy. There's almost, you know, if you give ground, you might lose, you know, the give an inch, they'll take a mile concept. So I think there is a little bit of, I'm not sure there's necessarily a lack of empathy, but I think there is this sort of desire to have a, have a side, and that's really creating some divisiveness in our country and making it hard for people to take others' perspectives.
Okay, Shira?
Well, yeah, I think the political climate sets a tone for adults, and adults set a tone for children. So I think that the more we can create spaces where children witness and observe adults modeling empathy with each other and with children, they socialize to look at the world that way and to understand that we can make connections even across differences rather than trying to win an argument or put another person down. So trying to encourage people to see a common humanity.
Okay. Sybil?
I think it's less about a blanket statement of there's a lack of empathy, in that I think our children and youth have fewer opportunities to practice being mindfully present, to practice active listening, to practice communicating in ways that convey compassion.
Well, I want to bring up a recent incident before we kind of dive into some of the specifics on the work that's being done by our guests in our community, what they're witnessing in school settings, and how we can all work to sort of cultivate more understanding and kind of cross these differences. Take a look at the issue recently, and don't worry, guests, we're not going to make this overtly political, though it might feel like that for a moment. Take a look at the caravan issue at the southern border. So when some of the people who were involved in the migrant caravan arrived at the border, there was a photo that went viral of a mother and child running from getting tear gassed. And most of our listeners have probably seen that by now. That's a hard moment. Now, I want to sort of try to honor the idea that there are Americans of good faith who agree and disagree about what we ought to be doing in regards to the caravan. I mean, I think you can come from different perspectives there. I think you can say, I can feel for the parents and children and the people who are fleeing oppression and violence while still being concerned about, what's the impact of an immigration system that some Americans might think is out of balance. And I think you can also say perhaps that the humane thing to do would be to be as welcoming and caring as you can be. What I don't understand is seeing that photo and the way some people shared it and said, USA, USA, never been more proud. What a great day for our country. No empathy whatsoever for a mother who just walked thousands upon thousands of miles, risking her life through multiple countries, just at the hope of getting away from violence. I don't understand that. So let me ask all three of you. I'll start with you, Shira. Isn't there a difference between saying, look, we don't have to agree on southern border policy, we don't have to agree on migration policy, but a lack of empathy or celebrating the tear gassing of a mother and child should probably be a little bit beyond the pale?
It's such a painful thing even now to think about as you talk about it. You know, what I think happens in our culture is that when we don't acknowledge our emotional reaction. So I think that we do naturally have an emotional reaction, but what we do is we just don't pay attention to it or put it into words. And so we stifle our ability to have empathy. And instead we go into our judgments, good, bad, right, wrong, right? Whose side are you on? So, you know, our philosophy teaching restorative practices is to come together and talk about things and kind of share our reactions, our feelings, our stories, without trying to prove a point, but just to have space to explore what is it like to see that, right? Because we can have different opinions and different strategies that we come up with. But let's just have a moment to share our personal human reaction to that. And I think when we tell stories, we all come from a different experience. It humanizes us. We can humanize somebody who has a different political view, a different strategy in mind. But, you know, we all are part of the same society. We were all socialized into this system that we live in. And I think we can recognize where somebody else may be coming from. How did they get that political viewpoint? When we tell stories about how we got here, we can then kind of start talking about how do we meet everybody's needs, right? Like you said, we want to meet our need for compassion and care and empathy and kindness. We also need to meet our need for safety and security and predictability. And there's not a conflict in terms of needs. There's only conflict in terms of strategies. So let's first take some time and just share what it's like for us to see that happening.
Okay, Sybil?
And those conversations are so important because the research has shown that we are more likely to be empathetic towards people who are like us. And so evolutionarily, that makes sense from a survival perspective. When we used to travel around in tribes, it would make sense that we would be more concerned about the people in our tribe than the people in the other tribes. However, we now live in this hyper-connected and diverse and interdependent world. And so I think the global challenge that we face is to recognize our shared humanity, that all human beings matter and that we're connected. And so in terms of teaching empathy in schools, it's not just teaching empathy in schools. It's also including empathy for people beyond our in-groups and beyond our borders.
That's really well said. Elizabeth, what do you think?
As you were talking, what I was thinking about is sort of the soundbite society we live in now, and mm-hmm. that, you know, everything is about putting out messages. It's all very one-sided. There's a lot of one-sided communication these days, and I think young people in particular are very used to that. So you're posting on Facebook, you're putting up a picture on Instagram, and you're, you know, tweeting, whatever it is it's all very one-sided. So there's no opportunity for dialogue in that kind of communication. And, you know, what struck me with those sort of America, you know, USA comments is that it is part of that soundbite. They were looking for the likes. How many likes am I going to get on this comment?
Yeah.
As opposed to really, you know, if you sat that person down and had a dialogue with them, you could get into some of the issues. Well, what do you mean by that? And what about that, mom? And, you know, those kinds of things. But right now, what is valued is getting a lot of likes on your posts and putting out this one-way communication. So I think kids are not having conversations, or they're not learning how to dialogue.
That's I think an astute point. So let's ask all of our guests to kind of describe the work that they're doing. And I think this is a good chance to kind of understand what's happening at Harley, RCSD, different schools and community settings, because our guests are doing work in different ways here to help with emotional intelligence and frankly, cultivating empathy in different ways. So I'm just going to sort of open the floor and ask our guests to tell you more about the work they're doing. And I'll start with you, Elizabeth. So I think our community probably needs more of this. I want to sign up for what you're all doing, but go ahead.
So, you know, we've working with a variety of school districts around the region, some in the rural areas, suburbs a little bit in the city. And often what we're doing is trying to come in and sometimes schools will come to us as saying, you know, we're having challenges with behavior, or we're seeing higher and higher needs among our students, more, you know, social and emotional needs, more stress, anxiety, suicide, some of these challenges. And so they'll come with that as a starting point. But then what we often get into discussing is how social and emotional skills are really something all kids need. This isn't something that just a certain pocket of, you know, children need, high need students, it's everybody. So how can we work on kind of building those supports and helping all kids sort of learn the social and emotional skills they need to be able to interact in the society, to have those communication skills? It's not just for a subset. So we, you know, start the conversation that way and try and help schools think about how to do it systemically. So we're doing starting with a needs assessment, often helping them think about, you know, what are the needs of their students and what do they have already in place. So many schools have dabbled in mindfulness. They've heard about restorative practices. They might be doing some circles. They've, you know, have a little bit of curriculum, that kind of thing. But it's not pieced together and it's not systemic. And so from a student standpoint, they're not sort of getting the benefit of that community building. So a lot of times where we'll start is just, you know, the adults are the first place to start. They really need to understand and embrace why these skills are important. So social and emotional skills often are broken into these five areas. So self-awareness, self-management, relationship skills, I'm forgetting one.
Responsible decision making.
So there are these sort of competency areas, and empathy is one piece of that. But I think empathy comes from is a relationship skill, but it's also a self-awareness skill. Sort of understanding who you are and what your perspective and points of view are going to help you then be able to understand someone else's.
I think one of my concerns is, and I'm talking about myself. I'm not, you know, sort of like wagging a finger at what other people need to do. There are times where I look back at either a conversation or a disagreement or an argument, and I think, did I want to know where that person was coming from, or was I just there trying to score a point? Mm-hmm. Did I actually actively try to understand why we might view things differently or behave differently, mm-hmm. or understand where they've been in their life that might lead them to it? And I'm not sure I do a good enough job in actually wanting that. Is that part of training people to not just understand that we are, you know, different, but to want to and value to know why someone comes to a different point of view?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I think understanding how to ask good questions and really listen to the answers is an important part of what we're talking about here. And I think, sort of diversity in schools in the past has often been, you know, having everybody bring in their favorite cultural meal for an event. And, mm-hmm. and you know, that's sort of where it ended. And I think that doesn't get to that underlying or deeper point you're making about really wanting to understand where somebody's coming from and what their background and traditions and sort of perspectives might, you know, all the different things that make them who they are. So I think schools are starting to do things like using literature as a way to kind of introduce a topic or a conversation where you can get kids talking about what's going on with that character in that book and why might they be thinking that. And that can sometimes depersonalize it and allow them to talk mm-hmm. about, you know, a character that doesn't mean that I'm listening to you and listening to you and listening to you, but everyone can kind of dive in and start thinking about what's going on with that character, where might they be coming from, what are sort of some of the background things that might be, you know, having an impact on the decisions they're making, how is that similar or different to what I would be doing. So sometimes that can make it less scary to talk about other people's perspectives. I think sometimes the adults are really nervous to bring these topics up with kids because they're not sure where the conversation's going to go, or they may not feel they have the skills to lead a conversation around perspective taking and that kind of thing, because it might escalate into something that they're not able to manage. So sometimes we're finding working with the adults on trying to figure out how to help them be more comfortable and tools and strategies mm-hmm. that help them feel more comfortable bringing these topics up in the classroom is often needed before you can even get into what the students are doing.
Yeah, and so let me turn to Shira May, who is Executive Director of Partners in Restorative Initiatives. So much of the work that our guests are doing will help with interpersonal relationships, students handling conflicts maybe in day-to-day situations. But also, I mean, I'm thinking about the way that the adults around them handle disagreements. And I'm going to take extreme examples now that go beyond just basic interpersonal disagreements. So when we encounter racism, sexism, homophobia, there is one school of thought, and I hear it from listeners all the time. Evan, you ask too many questions. You need to just declare that something is bad or wrong and move on. Like, that is, you know, you don't need to peel back the layers of the onion here. That if a person is expressing this viewpoint, you need to condemn it and move on. And my nature is to try to understand why someone feels a certain way. Mm-hmm. And there is a bit of a purity test thing that is kind of going on that says, look, get on the right side and condemn the other side, as opposed to, you know, try to understand where they are. Not to necessarily lift up a point of view that is potentially harmful, but to maybe uncover the roots of it so we can kind of get at where's our common humanity, where did it come from? Where do you draw lines in terms of saying, I'm done trying to understand you, what you're doing is hurtful, versus let me try to at least know why mm-hmm. you're espousing something that I think is really hurtful?
This is such an important discussion, and I hear about it in different activist settings, you know, for people who are fighting against racism and other kinds of systems of oppression, they have a very clear goal. We want to stop oppression from happening. So, but the question that I would come to is what's the most effective strategy that we can use for that? And sometimes when we come from our anger and our hurt, which we absolutely have, we're just not acting as effectively as we can. So I think there's an important place for us to take care of ourselves and kind of grieve and mourn and be with other people who are allies who can just absolutely be mad together. But then what can we do to be effective to make a difference and maybe change hearts and minds? When we talk to adults about some skills for speaking with students, for example, or other staff, we teach these three restorative questions. So if there's a conflict or a dispute, the first question would be, what happened? And that is, like you said, that curiosity. If I actually really want to know what's going on with you, what was going on in your mind, what were you thinking at the time, so to, you know, for example. And then I can answer the question. This is what was going on for me. This is how I saw it. The second question is, who has been affected? So that's a very different question from, is it right or is it wrong? So if I'm talking about a racist incident, you know, something that I found really really harmful, you know, I could say that was wrong, or I could say, here's what I saw happen. You know, this person felt very excluded. You know, I felt very uncomfortable and upset to see anybody, you know, excluded from our community. So we can express that emotion behind the it was wrong by saying how I'm affected and how others are affected. And it just changes the framework from kind of you know, punitive, you're wrong, and I'm going to absolutely, you know, beat you over the head with it, to a relationship-based approach where here's how your actions and words are affecting other people. And then the third question is, what can we do to make things right? So putting our relationship at the forefront, it's not about what punishment do you deserve or, you know, how I want to teach you a lesson about this. I mean, the teach part is the actual key. What can we do so that this doesn't happen again? You can learn from it, and I can learn from it, and maybe we can all as a community grow from it. So I think this is really relevant in schools, for number one, for adults to interact with other adults this way, because that's how children learn so much about how to grow into a human being, is how the adults interact and model. Secondly, how adults deal with student discipline issues. Mm-hmm. So one of our really big keys, you know, that a lot of schools are asking about is how can we reduce suspensions? How can we reduce disparities in suspensions and exclusions, especially racial disparities? And one of our key principles is the proactive community building. One of the biggest predictors of student success and preventing students from getting involved in the criminal justice system is feeling connected to school, a sense of belonging and being valued and being heard and seen. So that's really our number one key. We expect that a restorative school is a place where children feel a sense of belonging.
Yeah, we were talking the other day with the author of a new biography on Frederick Douglass about a speech that Frederick Douglass made at the unveiling of a monument that was meant to honor Abraham Lincoln's work. And at that speech, Douglass told President U.S. Grant, all of the members of the cabinet, that he said, Abraham Lincoln was the president for white America, and as an orator who is an African American, he said, we are still stepchildren of this country, and white people are the children of this country. Those words ring in my ears. I think about suspension rates. I think about who feels welcome in American schools. We cannot have a school system where students of certain backgrounds feel like the natural sort of inheritors of the right to go to school there, or the children of that school, and others feel like sort of on the fringes or stepchildren in the way that Frederick Douglass would describe it. And to the point that Scheer is making on suspension rates, I think the average school suspension rate disparity among children of color and white students is 4 to 6 to 8 times, 4 to 1, 6 to 1, 8 to 1 in most local school districts. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think across all different kinds of disciplinary actions, in particular, black children are receiving way more of these kinds of actions, from in-school suspension, out-of-school suspension, expulsion. And the really unfortunate part is a lot of the behaviors that stimulate these harsh reactions are things that are very vague, like disrespect or not following directions. Mm-hmm. And those are the kinds of things that can really come out of teacher biases. It's a hard topic to bring up. I'm being kind of courageous naming this, but I think it's really important. You know, we work with Rochester City School District is 80% African American population, student population, right? We really need to be responsible and have integrity as white educators to understand if we have biases, and we all do. It's not bad person, good person. We really all come with those kinds of biases. And there are tools that we can use to just notice, you know, the biases that we have in terms of student use of language or kinds of behaviors that mm-hmm. they're using. There are kinds of questions we can ask to de-escalate conflict so that we can connect with a student instead of sending them out of the room, for example. And as a school community, we can really commit to having that kind of proactive attitude where we're always learning. You know, one of the things I'm really interested in is how do we learn from our mistakes? Or, you know, we're always going to make mistakes. If somebody lets us know that was hurtful to me, you know, what's our obligation to be to maintain that relationship? You know, there's apology is one part of the process, but the next step is, what can I do to make it right? You know, can I do some learning on my part? Can I change my behavior? Is there something that you would like me to do to repair that relationship? So we're really trying to move away from a good guy, bad guy, you know, understanding of that we're all learning and growing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as someone who is perfect, it's easy for me to decide which friendships to sort of maintain and which to let wither, because it's easy for me to see flaws in others, having none myself. However, I would think for most people who have flaws, I have a question for you, Scheer, or even imagining myself as having flaws. It's weird, but we have these moments where we almost want to shut down a friendship or say, hey, did you know, we'll say to someone else, you know, your friend, you know, was making me very, I think your friend is a sexist. I think your friend is a racist, you know, and why are you friends with that person? Well, I will tell you that I have friends who I think are racist. And by the way, that's a whole other discussion on a sliding mm-hmm. scale of who is and who's not racist. I don't want to get into that right now. But I don't necessarily believe in just casting people out of my life when I find that they violate certain principles I would have, I actually pursue more dialogue and try to peel it back even more and understand it even more. Now, ultimately, I think we do gravitate to spend more time with people who are more like-minded, and I do that too. But I also don't believe in just casting people out if they have, you know, failed one of my sort of tests, whatever that may be. How do you feel about that?
I think that number one, it for me personally, it's really important to take care of ourselves. So if we're in a situation that is kind of crossed the line for us, so to me that means I don't have the skills or capacity to handle this relationship, it is okay to cut that off. I have cut off toxic relationships before and I'm doing much better. So that I think that that is actually really important. That's a boundary setting and a limit setting. But we also can stretch our capacity. So if we have a relationship that we really care about and we think, you know, it's worth the investment of time and energy to try to come together rather than separate, there are tools that we can learn. I think just unfortunately most of us haven't learned these social emotional skills of relationship building and assertive communication. So that's why we find our trainings really effective for educators, because they're learning, I can just go right to my card. Many teachers will wear this little index card right in their lanyard, and it's just you whip out the card and you can ask these questions to create dialogue. Without those skills, we get caught up in our emotions and we don't have a capacity to grow in that direction.
All right, Sybil Prince with the Harley School, and let's talk about the work that you're doing with the Harley School. I think your rather lengthy title reveals a little bit of the approach that you're taking with students on helping them develop relationships and emotional skills.
So in a lot of times in schools, traditionally, we teach empathy by reading books and trying to have students put themselves into the shoes of the students by watching documentary films and discussions. But research has shown that it is through developing relationships with other people, it's by having interactions with them, that is how we build these neural pathways that are associated with empathy and compassion. So through the Center for Mindfulness and Empathy Education, we're doing that through some different experiential programs. One of those powerful programs is our hospice program, which is a year-long program for 12th graders in which they take a class learning about a taboo subject in our culture, which is death and dying and grief and loss. And while they're reading books and watching films and having these intimate, powerful discussions on this topic, they're also learning the hands-on skills of caring for somebody at the end of their life. And these are the personal care skills, the hands-on skills, but also the social-emotional skills of how do you remain present with somebody who is suffering? How do you remain present with someone who's grieving? How do we actively listen to them and talk with them in ways that communicate compassion, which I think is really hard for us as adults as well. You only have to ask somebody who's lost a loved one or who has a disenfranchised or an ambiguous loss, such as a divorce or a miscarriage or a diagnosis of an illness, and they'll tell you that people oftentimes don't know how to respond. They don't know what to say. And, you know, a few weeks after the funeral is over, they're gone. They're on to their own life, and people are feeling really alone. So these are really important conversations to be having.
What are the impacts that you see on students?
Huge. Well, actually, so just this morning, I was thinking as Shira was talking, just this morning, I had a student come in she had a shift over the weekend in one of the 2-bed comfort care homes where the students are volunteering with people at the end of their lives. And she came in, she was all upset because she had been volunteering with one of the elderly residents there. And she felt like the family was really critical of her, that she could do no right, that they didn't like the way she repositioned the resident, they didn't like the way she was offering food to them. And she was so upset, and I could see the other students in the room around the table becoming more and more agitated too, like, oh, how dare they? Like, here you are coming in and volunteering your time, and they don't understand. I mean, that you're a volunteer, you're a student, and what other 17-year-olds go and spend their weekends volunteering with people who are dying? And after kind of beginning with that self-compassion, beginning with making sure she really felt heard and that her feelings were validated, those feelings of hurt and disappointment, it was moving on to then perspective taking of, okay, what would it be like to have your mother choose to be in hospice when you really wanted her to continue with her treatments? And you were feeling a lot of difficult anger, maybe you hadn't even named it for yourself, towards your mom for choosing this, for giving up. or maybe the family was, you know, watching their mother disappear before their very eyes. What would that be like? And for a 17-year-old who's, you know, sitting comfortably in this space of invincible, sure, you know, they're feeling invincible, their parents are healthy and well, that can be really hard, but they can go there. And it can be really powerful, the conversations that come out of, you know, trying to imagine what is it really like to be in that position. And, you know, the class ended this morning with the students still feeling, you know, a little disgruntled and hurt, but there was this shift, and I think that's where the first steps in empathy begin.
Well, I want to invite our listeners to share their thoughts, and some of you have already done that via email, which I will read after our only break of the hour. And we're going to continue to talk about empathy, emotional intelligence, how it's cultivated, what's happening in various school settings across our community and community settings, and if you think it's lacking sometimes in society. It's 844-295-TALK. If you want to call the program, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Sybil Prince is with the Harley School sharing their story. Shira May, Executive Director of Partners in Restorative Initiatives. Elizabeth Devaney is Director of the Social and Emotional Learning Center at the Children's Institute. We'll get to your emails. And there's one I think that will particularly stand out when we come back. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, could this be a bipartisan climate plan that can work? We examine what's happening in Washington with the hopes that some Republicans and Democrats have for achieving real climate policy now. Then in our second hour, a conversation with the outgoing and incoming CEOs for Ebero in Rochester. Talk with you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. When we talk about empathy, one of the examples I used earlier was the fact that I don't understand some of the celebrating that was happening on social media in particular over that viral image of a woman and her child running from tear gas at the U.S. border. They were part of the migrant caravan that came from Guatemala. And so I was simply expressing the fact that that's not a policy statement. I don't have the policy expertise to tell you what our immigration policy should be at all. I mean, I find it extremely complex, very, very difficult, and I find a lot of compelling arguments in a lot of different quarters there. I was simply saying I don't understand the idea of celebrating or laughing at a mom and her child getting tear gas. That's what I thought was beyond the pale. So Tom wrote to me and said, Evan, is it possible that the person who posted the picture with those celebrating comments was being facetious? Tom, no, not at all. In fact, let me read a different email, but I will also tell you, Tom, I mean, I appreciate the idea that maybe I was reading it wrong, but there was a lot of celebrating from high-profile people. I don't even want to name her name, but there are some high-profile folks to plenty of others. But here's Mike who emails me, and Mike, I'm going to read your email in good faith, and I'm just going to try to listen here. He says, Evan, if you want to understand why Americans hate immigrant invaders, I can explain it. First, I believe in the right of human beings to migrate. Not everyone understands that it's human nature to move and a human right to seek a better life. Evan is obviously a liberal snowflake who doesn't care about the tribal rights of Americans to exclude anyone who is not part of our own tribe. He wants to let in criminals who will take our stuff and hurt our families. He's not one of us. He's one of them. He has empathy for them, but none for us. So it's kind of simplistic, Evan, us versus them. That's from Mike. Okay, I mean, Mike, first of all, what I want to tell you here is, I think it's not a good faith argument to say that I want people to come take your stuff or hurt your family. I don't want anyone to do that. I really don't. I promise you that. And I don't want anyone to hurt my family or yours or anyone who is here or anywhere. But let's ask our guests to respond there. So Shira, you know, what's the message for Mike who thinks that I'm just a snowflake who cares more about others? My empathy does not extend to our own people, he's saying.
What comes to my mind is let's talk a little bit about the land that we live on right now. So we are, in fact, occupying land that has been lived on by the Haudenosaunee people, the Iroquois, for generations. As white people, we did not originate from this land, right? We're all either immigrants, descendants of slaves, or from Native Americans. I think that the idea that anybody has a right to, you know, keep other people out of this land in particular is not based in history. And just very honestly, it's taken me just till really recently to kind of grapple with this. You know, it's really, you know, you get a shift once in a while and you see the world very differently. And just lately being more educated about the history of Native American, you know, rights violations and, you know, boarding schools. And I just see this issue very, very differently. I see myself as a settler on this land. And it gives me a real sense of obligation, right, to treat others as respectfully as I can and to realize that I don't have any entitlement to live here. Just happen to be able to.
Okay. Sybil, what do you think?
I think that unfortunately, this perspective is not unique to this gentleman. There is this us versus them, this in-group versus out-group mentality that I think our leaders demonstrate by focusing on national interest to the exclusion of their global impacts. And you know, I worry about, you know, again, the research shows that this is something that I think is kind of in our genetics because of our history. But I think it's going to take some larger conversations around how can we move the focus from us versus them to more of our shared humanity and that all human beings matter. We're all connected.
Yeah, I'm returning to a point you made earlier this hour that research indicates we are more likely to show empathy for people who share our various characteristics.
Yep. So people who are the same ethnicity as us, people who are the same age, people who we're familiar with.
Yeah. Right? And I, you know, Elizabeth, I hear in Mike's email a genuine fear for his family, for his community. And this is going to annoy some listeners, but I want to honor that fear by saying, I think Mike's being honest. I think he is genuinely fearful of that. And I would like to have lunch with him and sit down and peel it back where that comes from. So Mike, that's an offer. I'm going to buy you, I'll buy you coffee. Let's start there. Lunch can get expensive. But the second trip I'll buy you lunch. And I'm serious about that, Mike. So I'm glad you emailed. You know, I don't know you, but I will do that. Because I want to understand that more. And I'm sure some listeners are annoyed by that. They'll probably say, don't do that. Don't buy that guy coffee. But Mike's a person with just as much right to opinions as me. So what do you think?
You know, I think it was bringing me back to just the point I was making before about I think in order to be empathic to others, you need to feel comfortable that somebody's being empathic towards you. And I think that's what I'm hearing in Mike's email is that there's sort of a lack of understanding of where he might be coming from. Mm-hmm. And so in order, you know, thinking about it in schools and working with kids, you really have to, you know, everybody in that school community needs to feel safe and comfortable and like their needs are being met, that they're being taken care of, that they're being heard. And I think that's one of the real problems and why things are getting so divisive today is that we aren't listening to each other. We don't feel that people understand where we're coming from. You know, I'm sure if you have that lunch and dig into it a little bit deeper, you might come to some more common ground than you think on the initial outset. But there's all of this sort of rhetoric, there's this communication that's happening. Again, you know, my point about one-way communication, you know, this is sort of two-way, but you're not seeing Mike in person. You know, a lot of people are willing to put things down in email that they wouldn't say to somebody's face. I think you can get into much more meaningful and deeper dialogue when you can have communication and in-person opportunities to speak with each other and kind of process things. And you know, teaching kids skills of how to have those kind of conversations so is really critical because, you know, it can get into a shouting match pretty quickly if you don't have the skills to to listen and ask questions and then also share your own point of view without getting heated and emotional. So some of those self-management skills that we were talking about in terms of competencies is a really important part of that dialogue.
Well, it's not like a way to a free coffee just to berate me. And now I see in Mike's follow-up email, I really, really didn't catch this because I'm pretty good at this. Mike says he wants to return to his point that he believes in the right of human beings to migrate, and the rest of his email was ironic. Oh, Mike, now I can't buy you a coffee. Boy, right over my head, man. But you know what, though? I will say this. To the extent that that email represents some viewpoints, because I read it because it certainly does. We have a country where demographics are shifting, and there are some fears about that people have. So, all right, if you're on board with the second half of Mike's email, original email, I will still buy you a coffee. Mike, thank you for participating with the program. I appreciate that. Laura in Rochester, next on the phone. Go ahead, Laura.
Hi, I just wanted to say, yes, it can be taught. I teach I taught my two-year-old with heart showing what was broken and when it was together. And every time that he made me upset, I would say, you know, did you break mommy's heart? And he would tell me yes, and then he would explain why. So I think it goes a lot to the parents who need to be teachers and to teach their kids.
Okay. Thoughts from our guests on that?
It made me think about, you know, some lessons. I think there are, you know, different ways of teaching it, but certainly, you know, I was thinking of a story where my son was telling my daughter the other day that she was being a me thinker because, you know, that was language he had learned in school. They're talking about me thinker versus we thinker. They're learning strategies for what it means to think about what you need, but then also think about what the group needs and where you need to think, when it's okay to focus on what you need and when it's okay to focus on what, you know, the group needs. And, you know, so I you hear in kids, they repeat the language back. And so he's in kindergarten, and it looks different at different age levels. But you'll often see that, you know, if you bring these things up, if you teach kids, if you have these dialogue and conversations, they'll actually process it and take it in pretty well. And at the younger ages, you'll really hear them kind of mimicking it back to you, which Laura's example just highlights.
Okay.
Yeah, I love the tools that we can use to give kids emotional literacy, emotional vocabulary. So with the, you know, young kids, images and, you know, sound effects and things like that are always fun. For older kids, we have, feeling vocabulary lists, and we can teach lessons about how to express ourselves really specifically, you know, and often we just kind of know mad, sad, glad, but there are so many feeling words that can really tell someone exactly, I am discombobulated, right? My favorite emotion word. And adults too, we need to learn ways to communicate just the feeling component of, rather than getting into right, our strategies and how we need to act with each other. So, and I think for parents, parenting is really hard. When I was a young, you know, parent, my son was two, I was really struggling, and I joined a parenting group that actually used mindfulness and emotional literacy and nonviolent communication, and it was a circle, so we passed a talking piece, and it totally transformed me. I think parents deserve so much support and respect.
Okay. Sybil, anything you want to add there?
Well, it just made me think of this situation that happened recently with one of our sixth graders who's 11 years old, and we have a program called WISE, which is Working Together Intergenerational Student Senior Exchange, that invites elders from St. John's Meadows to the Harley School to take a class with sixth graders. And in this class, you have 11-year-olds, and you have 80- and 90-year-olds, and you have 80- and 90-year-olds who have, you know, maybe they struggle with memory loss or a hearing impairment, or they ambulate more slowly. And then you have 11-year-olds who have their own sets of circumstances and challenges, and you put them together. And there was this situation the other day where the elder was working with the 11-year-old and was struggling to remember the name of a shape and in this activity they were working on. And the 11-year-old was just becoming so annoyed, like, what was wrong with you? Why I don't understand. What is wrong with you? And she was upset because they weren't going to be able to do the activity that she wanted to be able to do. And then the elder was becoming all agitated because I think she was embarrassed about the memory loss. And it was at the moment, I thought, this is a disaster. This is the worst thing. I don't know what I thought, thinking you could bring together 90-year-olds and 11-year-olds and get them to interact nicely with each other. But it was the most powerful learning opportunity and teaching moment for me in reflecting afterwards with the student, with this 11-year-old, in terms of talking about emotional literacy and looking at kind of what was she feeling in the moment and kind of processing it through with her and with the elder, kind of, again, perspective taking. So,
Well, let me get back to your phone calls. Herman and Brighton next on the phone. Go ahead, Herman. Herman, are you there? I'm not seeing Herman. No? Okay. There you are, just as I was going to punch the call. Go ahead, Herman.
Yeah. I attended a talk about a year ago by an official from HIAS, the Jewish Refugee Aid Organization, and I took some notes about polls that were taken in 1938 and 1939 about admitting more Jewish refugees. The poll in 1938 showed that fewer than 5% favored raising the immigrant quotas. Two-thirds actually said we should try to keep them out. In 1939, there was a poll that showed that two-thirds opposed letting in more Jewish refugee children. And the concerns that were expressed, the reasons that were given, is that Jewish refugees would be a danger to national security, or that Jews would bring communism to this country. So, in full disclosure, my parents and grandparents were refugees from Nazi Germany. Anyway, there's probably both xenophobia and anti-Semitism reflected in these polls, but I just thought some of these arguments are so, and these attitudes are so reminiscent of what we see today against other immigrant groups.
Mm. Herman, thank you for that. Agree, disagree? I mean, do we see the historical echoes there?
It's very scary. My parents, I'm also from Jewish Eastern European ancestry, and it's very frightening. It's, you know, I think I have really been in denial about the current tone, but I can see parallels, and I'm, you know, reading analysis where people are saying there are parallels to a fascist kind of worldview right now. So I think the work that we do is, it's not just critical for our kids and the communities and families that we serve, it's really critical for our world. So as human beings, we evolved to live in community, and all indigenous cultures around the world developed these community building structures, ways that we could get along and resolve differences and come up with agreements. And I think we had forgotten as civilizations what that's like. We became, you know, warlike, and we became, you know, colonizing. And so what we our task before us is to kind of come back to our humanity. How do we live together? How do we get along across differences? How can we make a better world for our children? And it's not just an exercise. This is really critical.
Well, one thing that we know is that we are, as an American society, living more polarized around. We're separating ourselves by a lot of different, we're sorting in a lot of different ways. We're sort of self-sorting. And so to the extent that you want to raise empathetic children, again, that point that Sybil raised, you know, the research showing your children are going to be more empathetic to people who are like them. So if they are going to school in places, if they're growing up in neighborhoods that where there's not a lot of diversity in a lot of different ways, then, and that extends to diversity of thought, then there's going to be some active work that we all have to do. But then there's a question on how do we get better as adults. And CJ writes to us and says, Evan, where do adults go for lessons on this? How can adults find a path, especially if they do not enjoy reading, CJ says. Any thoughts on this? You want to become a more empathetic adult. What are we going to do?
I took a training on compassionate communication, on nonviolent communication, which was very powerful for me in terms of developing a language to have around difficult conversations. And sure, I'm sure you can talk more about that with nonviolent communications, but that is something I would absolutely recommend. You don't need to read a book to do it.
Where was the class you took?
So I took it at the First Unitarian Church on Winton Road. I'm not sure if they still offer them, but I know that they do offer them on a regular basis through the Gandhi Institute.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to say that probably the Gandhi Institute. If you want to start mm-hmm. there, CJ, either they've got something or they will know something. Mm-hmm. The Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester will point you in a direction probably that you want to go.
Yeah.
It's a good way to start there.
Mm-hmm. We have trainers that also use that tool, and I think it's very powerful. And I also want to say mindfulness. I think mm-hmm. being able to mm-hmm. calm ourselves and give ourselves all that self-care and come to a good place and regulate ourselves is absolutely essential.
Well, let me ask, close the program by asking our guests, if you, given sort of everything that's happening right now in our country, if you look at kids in our schools, if you look at our communities, and you find yourself an optimistic about the direction we're going in terms of understanding one another, empathy, bridging divides, do you have to force optimism? Or Elizabeth, do you find yourself an optimist about where we're going?
That's an interesting question. I think when I think about the adults, I don't feel terribly optimistic. But when mm-hmm. I think about kids, I do feel some optimism because I'm looking at what's happening in schools. I see how kids are talking to each other, and I think they're having a different tone. And if we can get our act together as adults so that they're not reflecting what we're presenting to them, like Shira said at the beginning, I think we have an opportunity, a real opportunity. So I do feel optimistic about that.
Okay, sure.
I'm an optimistic person by nature, but I focus on the task in front of us just to change one heart and mind at a time. I love this story we often tell about a person who is finds a bunch of sea stars on the beach, and he's one by one returning them into the ocean. And there are hundreds and hundreds of them on the sand, and a bystander comes by and says, well, why bother returning one or two or three to the ocean? All of these hundreds are still going to be on the sand. And he said, well, it makes a difference for this one. I think we just need to do that work, and we're planting seeds for the future.
Okay, Sybil?
Yeah. I feel optimistic. I'm an optimistic person by nature, and I feel a lot of hope in that kind of the time and money, the resources that our school districts, especially in this area, and private schools are putting into social-emotional learning and experiential opportunities for students to practice learning skills around empathy. So that makes me feel hopeful kind of locally.
Yeah, kids really are awesome. Kids always impressed me about how happy they are just to be together, to be around people who love them, to be around friends. And it's hard not to be hopeful when you're hanging out with kids. So I want to thank our guests for the work they're doing for kids in this community, for adults in this community, for everyone here. Our guests coming to us this hour from the Harley School, from Partners in Restorative Initiatives, from the Social and Emotional Learning Center at the Children's Institute, organizations doing so much. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you all.
Thanks so much.
Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections. Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, looking for coffee with Mike, and probably plenty more. Let's have a great afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.